Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Howard Zinn at his absolute finest. He discusses the futility of war, the necessity of disobedience, and the power of the people. I hope you'll stay tuned. Let me tell a little story from history, a story in which Howard Zinn played a part. It's mid-April 1945, and the war in Europe is pretty much over. The Germans still technically occupied France, but at least in the Bordeaux region, German troops were basically lying low and waiting for Germany's final surrender. The German and the Free French officers in the region had made their own armistice. If the Germans would not attack the port of Bordeaux, the French would not attack the German troops, as long as they behaved themselves. Germany's official surrender would come 3 weeks later. Then, on April 14, and again on the 15th, and again on the 16th, 1,200 American heavy bombers attacked Bordeaux's seaside resort town of Royan. The bombers flew at an altitude of 25,000 feet. Howard Zinn was a flight crew member on those raids, a bombardier. He recalled seeing the bombs fall, and many seconds later, the explosions. Over 3 days, the Air Corps destroyed Royan with 2,000-pound high-explosive bombs, with incendiary bombs, and with a new type of jellied gasoline bomb the Air Force was eager to try out. This was the first use in war of napalm. According to Bombardier Zinn, that raid had no clear military target. Even if there had been one, at an altitude nearly 5 miles high, the planes were incapable of hitting anything with any precision, not even with a much ballyhooed Norden bombsight. Well, the bombardier ought to know. After 3 days of carpet bombing, the town of Royan was totally destroyed. Almost every building was demolished. Possibly among the casualties were some German soldiers, who, you recall, were pretty much just holed up waiting for their country's final surrender. The overwhelming majority of the casualties were French civilians. You know, the people we were trying to liberate from the Nazis. In all, between 1,200 and 1,400 people were killed in that raid. Of the 1,200 bomber planes in the raid, only 5 were lost from all causes. For what purpose was this town obliterated? 20 years after the war, Zinn visited the Bordeaux region and researched French and American records of the Royan bombing. The French consistently described it as a tragic and terrible mistake. But the Americans justified the raid as protecting the port of Bordeaux. Studying the records, Zinn came to the conclusion that the raid had 2 real reasons. The first was crew morale. All those bomber pilots and crewmen were hanging around week after week with nothing left to bomb. Tempers were getting short. The men were getting itchy. Okay, let's give them something to bomb. Keep them busy and out of trouble. Give them another successful combat mission to put on their resumes. Here's the second real reason. The generals were real eager to try out these new 100-pound napalm bombs. They're supposed to be much better than regular incendiaries at burning people alive. The flaming jelly sticks to your skin, you can't get it off, and you can't put out the flame. This war is going to be over any day now, so if we want to test out this new stuff, we'd better do it soon. So we tried out the new napalm bombs, not on enemy troops, not even on innocent German civilians, but on innocent French civilians. The very people we were fighting to liberate from the yoke of Nazi oppression, as we like to say. Good news! The napalm worked beautifully. So much for the good war. Howard Zinn's good essay on Royan is in the anthology of his essays, The Zinn Reader. I recommend the whole book. In today's third and final installment of his 2008 talk, Zinn refers briefly to bombing a peaceful town of no strategic importance. That's Royan. He did it. Today, Zinn begins by talking about war in general, its insanity, and its counterproductiveness. Not just our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, all wars, including the alleged good war, World War II. Zinn's words that we'll hear today are the finest and most moving I have ever heard him speak. He speaks, well, of the futility of war. He also speaks of how disobedience is essential to democracy, and of how people have real power when they organize themselves into social movements. From November 2008, here is the late, great Howard Zinn.
I have to say something about war, a little more than I've said, because I've emphasized the importance of renouncing war and not being a war-making nation, and because it will not be enough to get us out of Iraq. One of these days, we'll get out of Iraq. We have to get out of Iraq. We don't belong there, and we're going to have to get out of there. One sooner or later, we're going to have to get out of there. But we don't want to have to. We don't want to get out of Iraq and then have to get out of somewhere else. We don't have to get out of Iraq, but keep troops in Afghanistan, as unfortunately, you know, Obama said, troops in Afghanistan. No. No more, not just Iraq. We have to get into a mindset about renouncing sort of war, period, and which is a big step. And my ideas about war, my thoughts about war, the conclusions that I've come to about war, they really come from two sources. One from my study of history. Of course, not everybody who studies history comes to the same conclusions. But, you know, you have to listen to various people who study history and decide what makes more sense, right? I've looked at various histories. I've concluded that my history makes more sense. I've always been an objective student of these things, yes. My ideas about war come from two sources. One of them is studying history, the history of wars, the history of governments, the history of empires. That history helps a lot in straightening out your thinking. And the other is my own experience in war. And, you know, I was in World War II. I was an Air Force bombardier. I dropped bombs on various cities in Europe. That doesn't make me an expert. Lots of people were in wars, and they all come out with different opinions. Well, so all I can do is give you my opinion. Based on my thinking, after having been in a war, I was an enthusiastic enlistee in the Air Force. I wanted to be in the war against fascism, the good war, right? But at the end of the war, as I looked around and surveyed the world and thought about what I had done and I thought about and learned about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and learned about Dresden, and learned about Hamburg, and learned things I didn't even realize while I was bombing. Because when you're involved in a military operation, you don't think. You just, you know, you're an automaton, really. You may be a well-educated and technically competent automaton, but that's what you aren't really, you're not questioning. Not questioning why are they sending me to bomb this little town? The war is almost over. There's no reason for dropping bombs on several thousand people. No, you don't think. Well, I began to think after the war. I began to think that, and I was thinking now about the good war, the best war. And I was thinking, oh, and then I began to see, no, this good war is not simply good. This best of wars, no. And if it's true of this war, imagine what is true of all the other obviously ugly wars about which you can't even use the word good. And I began to realize certain things, that war corrupts everybody. Corrupts everybody who engages in it. You start off, they're the bad guys. You make an interesting psychological jump. The jump is this. Since they're the bad guys, you must be the good guys. No. They may very well be the bad guys. They may be fascists and dictators and bad, really bad guys. That doesn't mean you're good. You know? And when I began to look at it that way, I realized that wars are fought by evils on both sides. You know, one is a little more evil than the other. But even though you start in a war with sort of good intentions, we're going to defeat fascism, we're going to do this, you end up being corrupted. You end up being violent. You end up killing a lot of innocent people because you've decided from the beginning that you're right, and then you don't have to ask questions anymore. That's an interesting psychological thing, that trick that you play. Say, well, you start out, you make a decision at the very beginning. Decision is, they're wrong, I'm right. Once you have made that decision, you don't have to think anymore. Then anything you do goes. Anything you do is okay because you made the decision early on that they're bad, you're good. Then you can kill several hundred thousand people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Then you can kill 100,000 people in Dresden. It doesn't matter. You're not thinking about it. Yeah, war corrupts everybody who engages in it. What else can I say about war? Lots of things. You know, people will present you with humanitarian wars. Oh, this is for a good cause. The thing about wars is the outcome is unpredictable. The immediate thing you do is predictable. The immediate thing you do is horrible, because war is horrible. And if somebody promises you that, well, this is horrible, like, you know, we have to bomb these hundreds of thousands of people in Japan. This is horrible, but it's leading to a good thing. Truth is, you never know what this is leading to. You never know the outcome. You never know what the future is. You know that the present is evil, and you are asked to commit this evil for some possible future good. It doesn't make sense. Especially since if you look at the history of wars, you find out that those so-called future goods don't materialize. You know, the future good of World War II was, oh, now we're rid of fascism, now we're going to have a good world, a peaceful world. Now the UN Charter, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 50 million people died in World War II, but now it's going to be okay. Well, you've lived these years since World War II. Has it been okay? Can you say that those 50 million lives were, had to be done because of what? No, the wars, violence in general, is a quick fix. It may give you a feeling that you've accomplished something, but it's unpredictable in its ends. And because it's corrupting, the ends are usually bad. So, okay. I won't say anything more about war. Of course, it wastes people, it wastes wealth, it's an enormous, enormous waste. And so what is there to do? We need to educate ourselves and other people. We need to educate ourselves in history. History is very important. That's why I went into a little history, because if you don't know history, it's as if you were born yesterday. If you were born yesterday, then any leader can tell you anything. You have no way of checking up on it. History is very important. I don't mean formal history, what you learn in a classroom. No, the history that you learn, go to the library. Go to the library and learn history. Yeah, we have an educational job to do with history. We have an educational job to do about our relationship to government, you know, and to realize that disobedience is essential to democracy. You see. Yeah. And it's important to understand democracy is not the three branches of government. It's not what they told us in junior high school. Oh, this is democracy. We have three branches of government, kiddos, the legislative, the executive, judicial. We have checks and balances. We balance one another out. If somebody does something bad, it will be checked by another. Wow, what a neat system. Nothing can go wrong. Well, those structures are not democracy. Democracy is the people. Democracy is social movements. That's what democracy is. And what history tells us is that when injustices have been remedied, they have not been remedied by the three branches of government. They've been remedied by great social movements, which then push and force and pressure and threaten the three branches of government until they finally do something. Really, that's democracy. We mustn't be pessimistic. We mustn't be cynical. We mustn't think we're powerless. We're not powerless. That's where history comes in. If you look at history, you see people felt powerless and felt powerless and felt powerless until they organized and they got together and they persisted and they didn't give up and they built social movements, whether it was the anti-slavery movement or the black movement of the 1960s or the anti-war movement in Vietnam or the women's movement. They started small and apparently helpless. They became powerful enough to have an effect on the nation and on national policy. We're not powerless. We just have to be persistent and patient, not patient in the passive sense, but patient in the active sense, of having the kind of faith that if all of us do little things, at some point there will be a critical mass created. Those little things will add up. That's what has happened historically. People were disconsolate and people thought they couldn't, but they kept doing, and then something important happen. And I'll leave you with just one more thought. That if you do that, if you join some group, if you join whatever the group is, a group that's working on, you know, gender equality or racism or immigrant rights or the environment or the war, whatever group you join or whatever little action you take, you know, it will make you feel better. It will make you feel better. I'm not saying we should do all these things just to make ourselves feel better, but it's good to know that life becomes more interesting and rewarding when you become involved with other people in some great social cause. Thank you.
Historian Howard Zinn, in one of his last major speeches in Binghamton, New York, November 8, 2008. We have time for a little bit of the Q&A that followed.
Question from the left and a question from the right. I like that.
Thank you, Professor Zinn, for joining us. I was really interested in your discussion of the word we and how it's kind of misused. But I was interested that you still kind of used it. I would tend to talk more in terms of, you know, they have built this empire and they are fighting this war and they never asked us, the real we, what we think. So I was hoping you could explain and make a little more explicit about why you choose to use the word we in the way that you do.
Well, I think I explained that, you know, we're so socialized and so polluted mentally that we keep using these words. We don't mean it. So, yes, even I, as smart as I am, find myself using the word we when I don't mean it, when I mean they. should have a little signal that comes out from the ceiling that warns me that I'm about to use the word we when I should use the words that they. I mean, of course, you're right. And I apologize profusely.
So all these questions seem somewhat related. So I was wondering, what do you think we should do with all this energy and this activism and this enthusiasm now if the Democrats, as you pointed out, continue to be to the right of the majority of the population? Do we continue to try to make them more progressive, or especially the young voters, abandon them completely, all our money, all our efforts, and go full force to a third party?
Well, I don't think in terms of parties. I think in terms of movements. So, no, I generally believe in, and I told this to Ralph Nader. I want you to know I'm on speaking terms with Ralph Nader. I said, the voting arena, the electoral arena, is not the arena for people like you and me. That's not it. And so I wouldn't try to divert people's energy to this party or that party. I think third parties play their role, as I just said. But that's not the important thing. The important thing, you know, is using this energy that you spoke of, this enthusiasm that you spoke of, to organize people in communities around the country. Look, that's what Martin Luther King was doing. You didn't see Martin Luther King running for office. You didn't see him playing an electoral role. You know, you see him mobilizing people. Before his death, you see him walking with the strikers in Memphis. You see him planning, you know, this tent city across the Potomac, a poor people's campaign. You see him engaging in direct action. That's what you see. And that really is the important thing. And I do believe that thinking about parties, whether it's Democrat or third party, is very much a diversion, you know. Yeah. The electoral system is overplayed and overpraised and saps a lot of energy that could go into community organizing. Well, okay, let's...
But I'm wondering what your personal... I know Noam Chomsky is a proclaimed anarchist. I'm wondering what your personal opinion is of anarchy as an ideology.
Well... trying to get me into trouble. You probably may know that one of my great heroes is Emma Goldman, you know, the great feminist anarchist. You know, very often people try to categorize me, you know. They approach you and say, what are you? They want a one-word answer. It's like, you know, the true-false tests that you get in school. What are you? I say, well, actually, I'm not sure. I'm a little bit of this and a little bit of that. So are you a Marxist? Are you an anarchist? Are you a socialist? Are you a communist? Are you a liberal? Well, I'm something of a Marxist. I'm something of an anarchist. I'm something of a socialist. I'm not really a liberal. In the New Yorker, a few issues ago, there was some letters. They printed some of the letters of Norman Mailer, who, you know, died not recently. And he was writing a letter to Playboy magazine, which had interviewed him. And Playboy magazine referred to Norman Mailer as a liberal. And he wrote to them, he said, please. He said, you can call me anything you want. You can call me a socialist. You can call me an anarchist. You can call me a Bolshevik. You can call me an outcast and... an outlaw. You can call me anything, but don't call me a liberal. Anyway, okay, who's next? Oh, wait, well, I didn't really answer that question, did I? I didn't answer that question. I'm sorry. If you simply say, oh, I believe in anarchism, well, people will, you know, shudder. Because, you know, there are misconceptions about anarchism. Think, oh, anarchists, they're violent bomb throwers. No. No, governments are violent bomb throwers. You know, there have been some anarchists in history who've been bomb throwers. There also have been Democrats who have been bomb throwers, Republicans who have been bomb throwers. Governments have been the biggest bomb throwers. But actually, most anarchists have been rather nonviolent. You know, Tolstoy, I'm going to say Tolstoy and Thoreau and Gandhi. And so there's a misconception about anarchists being violent people. Or no, anarchists don't believe in my kind of anarchist doesn't believe in violence or bomb throwing or anything like that. The other misconception is of anarchists believe in disorder. No rules, no regulations, do what you want. The smoke while not wearing a seatbelt. You know, no, anarchists just don't believe in centralized government. They don't believe in centralized power, the centralized power of government or the centralized power of the church or the centralized power in the economy. They believe in kind of loose conglomeration of collectives in the society with real democracy, not the democracy that comes through voting, but the democracy that comes through people getting together, you know, all over and making decisions by themselves. And there are little examples of that in history. Read the history of the Paris Commune of 1871. Read the history in George Orwell's book, Homage to Catalonia, about when the anarchists took over in early 1936, Catalonia, Barcelona, and you see, an order not enforced by punishment, an order that comes out of people's cooperation. Amazing how that can work.
The late historian Howard Zinn. He died a little more than a year after these words were spoken. For the original 90-minute recording, our thanks to Lynn Gurry, longtime producer and host of the Unwelcome Guests radio program. And I am Kenneth Doust, longtime producer and host of New World Notes. In any case, from Darkest Connecticut, I thank you for listening. You can find more of us on our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. As Zinn reminds us, disobedience is essential to democracy. The people are not powerless, and, if I may slip in one of my own, what have you got to lose by tuning in again next week? Till then.